So this is talking with Sir Bernard Lovell at Grenoble on 1st September 76.
Now, hello, Gus.
I got my degree at Maryland, so he knows about what I'm up to. What I'm interested in is, of course, the stuff that is not available in the published record. And so if you could first just tell me about what your training was and then how it was that you came in contact with radio astronomy, or what came to be called radio astronomy. It wasn't that at that time.
Well, I think in order to save a long story, when the information is published, I might refer you to that.
Well, are you going to be publishing some more about this?
No, not at all. But essentially, the answer to that question is contained in the first chapters of my book, The Story of Jonathan Beck.
Right.
And so perhaps this brief comment you could fill up by referring to that.
Okay.
I was trained as a physicist. I worked with Blackett on cosmic rays before the war. And during the war, I was concerned with radar development and had noticed the odd reflections on the radar screens of the defense radars.
Mm-hmm.
I discussed this with Blackett, and we wrote a paper, which is published in 1941 on the proceedings of the Royal Society.
Yeah, I know that paper.
And that is really the key to the whole of this. And it was agreed that if we survived the war, I would get some radar equipment. And I said, these wasps are terrible. Do you think we could go somewhere where we shan't get stung? We seem to be near a nest.
Okay. Let's see if we can.
So we're rolling again.
Continuing. Yes. So was the
idea? Then after the war, I took a lot of the radar equipment with which I had designed and which I'd been working during the war. I had sufficiently high level connections in the defense community to arrange to take this away. And we first of all, Blackett and I set it up in the quadrangle of the main physics department of the university. The intention being to look for radar reflections from large cosmic ray showers.
Now,
there was so much interference there that we eventually moved out to Jonathan Beck. Well, I'm really repeating what has already been published about that.
But let me just ask you, there was no time during the war to follow up these strange echoes.
Oh, absolutely not at all.
But your notion was that they were due to cosmic rays. Did you think at all about meteors at that stage?
Not at all. No, I knew absolutely nothing about meteors.
Right.
In fact, one of the first things we did after the war, when we discovered it, I knew nothing about Hayes' work, or Schaefer's work.
You never you never saw this report that Hay published?
No, I did not see Hay's report, or I was working in the Air Ministry and he was in the Army Department.
I see. Most of the people I've talked about have seen that.
Well, it's extremely unlikely that they saw it before it was declassified and published in the paper in 1946. Who claims to have seen it during the war?
Well, let's see. Christensen?
Well, they may have done. It depends on where they were working.
But Mills? Dickey?
Well, I wonder if they're probably...
But of course, the memories can play tricks.
Their memory must have played tricks. I don't think...
You think it was so secret that
they couldn't possibly have seen it until after the war. It was a secret document, which was not being classified, I think, until 1946.
Well, what they said was that everyone was aware that there was this interference. Maybe they only heard it through the grapevine and didn't actually see the report. But in any case, you were not.
Well, in any case,
you were not aware of it.
I wasn't aware of it. I was was completely monopolized. Immediately after I wrote that paper with Blackett, the Blitz descended on us, and then I think for 3 or 4 years, everything we were concentrating on.
But let me just ask you.
You might incidentally. Yeah. There is one other publication you might refer to, which contains another reference to this, and that is my long memoir. Published in the Biographical Memoirs of the Royal Society of November 1975 on Lord Blackett.
I made a note of that. I haven't looked at it myself.
I do refer to this incident again there.
Yeah. Let me ask you, various people have told me that working on radar during the war sort of set the style for how they worked after the war. Was this true with you? I mean, was this sort of a valuable training ground?
Undoubtedly. I think there were two very important factors in this. And incidentally, although I'm speaking from the point of view of an Englishman, I think at that time,
compared with America and the rest of the world, we were very advanced, you see. So the situation may be different now. You've now got to think back to the 1930s. There were two very important aspects of this. First of all, although I was working in a very advanced technological laboratory on cosmic rays with Blackett, the impact of the techniques in the Air Ministry establishment, which I transferred, absolutely astonished me. There was a different order of magnitude.
Yeah.
A minor example, which I still remember, is we were still using soldering irons heated in a Bunsen burner.
I see.
Where they're electricity, that's a minor technological one. And the other important factor was one was completely removed from one's isolation. One suddenly realized that dealing with people, one suddenly realized that the scientific problem was only a part of the real problem which one had to deal with when doing research. I remember Blackett writing to me when I complained about bureaucracy in the beginning of the war, and I'd been removed to a remote aerodrome, and he wrote back very sharply and said that you will have to learn that the people with whom you have to deal present you with more than 80% of the technical problems or the problems of research. It might have been an exaggeration.
Right.
But so I think both from those points of the impact of new techniques, new technology, and also over the years of the war, the tremendous experience one got in dealing with situations and people.
Right.
As far as I'm concerned, I think John LeBanc would never have happened without that.
In the sense that you would not have known how to develop a group?
I would not have had the contacts. I would not have had the contacts at high levels which was necessary to bring into existence a place like that. And neither would I have had the experience to do so. Creating an establishment like the Jodrell Bank is not a technical...
it's
a matter of technique.
Yeah. Well, like you say, the early meteor radar thing is documented quite well in your book. Although, I should add that I think meteor radar astronomy is one thing that I'm going to de-emphasize in my study, since it's a bit apart from the rest of radio astronomy. And it's also been... Have you seen a thesis by this fellow named Nigel?
No, I haven't.
No, Nigel Gilbert is his name. In which he has done this whole thing, and so he's really just concentrated on one small area.
Yes. I can understand it's your decision, but meteor...
Please protest if you wish.
Well, I think in a proper historical study of the subject, I would protest. Because if you take this place where we are now, IAU, there is a great discussion about the future of Commission 40. Things move out of Commission 40.
That's right.
When we set up IAU, the first meetings of the commissions were about half a dozen of us, or perhaps a dozen of us, the same with IRSI. The solar radio emissions, the radar observations of meteors, the aurora, and then of the moon formed the main part of our study, you see. So one might well say, in another 10 years, you would say that same attitude about solar physics, solar radio astronomy. However, that's your
No, I think your point is well taken. Yeah. What you're saying is that although it lapsed in the mid-50s and became a very minor part of...
Well, we moved away from meteor astronomy when we cracked the main problems, and when we got the big telescope, which was in which we would have been wasting the facilities and the technical capability of our big telescopes to study meteors.
But what you're saying is, at that time, it was as big as radio sources, or
bigger. We did solve one of the major problems of solar system astronomy, namely where the meteors were confined to the solar system. It was the meteor studies by ourselves, and also almost simultaneously by Milman and McKinley in Canada, which removed this myth of the hyperbolic orbits.
And how had this myth become established?
The myth had become established through the work of Hofmeister on fireballs and of Erpic, who observed in Arizona in the Harvard meteor program. Now you will find, it's hard to keep referring you to my own writings, but to save a lot of repetition. You should also read I refer to my monograph on meteor astronomy.
Yes, in 54.
You almost said, which contains a full account of of this situation.
So, I guess this could be said to be important with the origin of the solar system cosmogony problems. Would you say? Does it really bear on that, or not?
Yes, I think so. And of course, our early associations with Fred Whipple, because of our new work on the meteors turned out to be extremely important.
With the flare stars later.
The connection which still continues and led to many things, including eventually, 20 years later, my own researches on the flare stars in collaboration with
Well, in fact, I'm going to talk to him later this afternoon. But what I'm trying to get at is that everyone knows about the cosmology work that came out of the radio source counts and so forth, and of course we're still arguing today whether it's not as relevant to cosmology, but nevertheless it was thought to be. And this is not cosmology, but this work definitely had a bearing on cosmogony.
Yes.
Well before that time.
Yes, indeed. Know. Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. Now, at an IRSI meeting, say in Sydney in 52, was meteor radar astronomy discussed as much as radio sources and galactic background?
No, I was not at the IRSI meeting in 52.
Oh, I see.
I was at the previous one in Zurich, I think, must have been in the late 1940s. And and also in 57, the IRSI meeting in Boulder. The subjects of radio meteors, should we call them, and reflections from aurorae were still very prominent. After 1957, we were just at the beginning of the International Geophysical Year.
Right.
And I think still at that time, it would not have been possible to make a realistic separation.
Yeah. With the same... Oh, go ahead.
Of the radar studies.
Were the same people working on reflection from aurorae as reflection from meteor trails?
Yes, I think in the first few years after the war, you'll find that I wrote papers, some of my papers were on meteors and some were on aurorae.
I see, I didn't realize that.
I think in the first, I can't remember exactly, but if you like, I can send you a complete list of our reprints from Jodrell.
I have that, actually.
Oh, you do have
that?
Yes,
but I can't remember,
I think if you look that up, you'll see that... the establishment, I believe that I myself published papers on aurorae, certainly meteors, and also on the sun.
Yeah. So it seems like it was a great mixture of atmospheric and
atmospheric
physics and astronomy.
Yes.
Now, what did
that didn't apply to all establishments. I think in the case of Cambridge, they did not get into the transmitter game there at all. They were associated with the sun mostly.
In the very beginning.
In the very beginning.
Of course, they got in the ionosphere when Cygnus was fluctuating and such.
Yeah.
What did you consider yourself in the late 40s? If someone said, what do you do, or how do you pigeonhole yourself, what would you have answered?
Well, I was, it's difficult to think back what I thought then. But the facts are that I was, after the war, I returned as a lecturer in physics in the University of Manchester, and I have remained in the physics department and am still in the physics department.
And is your chair titled
But
physics?
I think, no. I think mine was the... I think Clegg and I are probably in our book, Radio Astronomy. I should think we were possibly nearly the first people to use the term radio astronomy. This was one of the books, published book back in 1948, I think.
Right.
I don't know whether you've seen that.
Yes, I have. I have a copy.
And then I think my own chair, which Blackett created, in his department, was certainly the first chair of radio astronomy.
And what year was that?
Yeah, it was 1952. That is certainly true, but I think I occupied the first chair of radio astronomy. But I still remain. I was trained as a physicist, and in this odd situation, you see, of never really having attended any undergraduate lectures on astronomy.
Right.
And yet one becomes an astronomer.
Someone has told me about lectures given by Kopal sort of weekly. I guess it was Hanbury Brown. Did you used to attend those at Jodrell?
That was, yes, but we're moving on in history now. That was in the 1950s.
Early 50s, though.
That was in the early 50s.
Well, I'm just wondering how you acquired your astronomical education. Was it simply... when something popped up, you had to go find a book on meteors or something?
Well, that's an interesting question. And the answer is that since we ran into the meteor phenomenon in a very big way because of the Jacobinids on October the 10th, 1946.
Right.
And then the discovery of the daytime meteor showers. We had by that time naturally searched for
people in England who knew about meteors. And the strange answer was that they were mostly, almost entirely, amateurs in the British Amateur Astronomical Society. And the man who educated me a great deal about meteors was, in fact, a solicitor, Prentice, whose name you'll find there.
Right.
Well, this was a marvelous training, because if you're an observer of visual meteors, you know a hell of a lot about the sky.
Right.
And that is really how we learned our fundamentals of astronomy. In the best possible way, I think.
You might well have been one of the only early radio astronomers who knew the constellations and such.
I learned most of my astronomy sitting out in a deck chair in the depths of the night by the side of Prentice.
Right.
Yes. Yeah. And it is true, the co-pilot, Blackett, when Blackett realized that we were on to a good thing, he was a man greatly interested in cosmology and the future and so on. And he realized that although we were grasping the elements of astronomy, that we could still be subject to criticism because we were not professional astronomers. And therefore, he persuaded the university to create this chair of theoretical astronomy as well as radio astronomy.
I see.
And that is how Kopal.
And that was the same year as
it was the same year, the point of the same year. And what Palmer said was perfectly true. Kopal came out and gave us regular lectures. But my memory is that most of my fundamental astronomy, constellations or orbits, all that sort of thing, was learned the hard way.
Yeah, yeah. Let me ask about the influence of Blackett. It seems that he must have been rather important in terms of someone looking at the group. You never see Blackett's name or anything, but that he must have always been in the background giving great support. Is that
absolutely
a fair assessment?
Yes. I think if you haven't got a copy of my memoir, I think I must send it to you, because he was a... This is a small book, by the way. It's not in the
Bishop I see. Oh, it's a small book.
Oh, yes. It's published by the Royal Society, and it was published originally in the memoirs, but it's been reissued as a small book.
Oh yes, I'd very much like
to have
one.
It's about 70 or 80,000 words. I'll make a note and send you that, because you will see from that what an immense influence Blackett was, not only on me, but also on the rest of his staff, on people like Runcorn, for example, who's here.
Yes.
He's now known for geomagnetism and geological studies, and as well as nuclear physics. You haven't got a copy of the...
No, I don't. I remember making a note that I'd seen it referred to somewhere. But
Shall I send this in?
Well, I'm in the IAU directory, W.T. Sullivan.
Yes, but you wrote to me from Groningen.
Oh, yeah, no, that was just the summer I met. Yeah. I was there.
So you want the USA address?
Yeah, Department of Astronomy, University of Washington, Seattle, Washington.
All right. Well, I hope my stuff from Groningen will be sent on.
Oh, no, it will. It definitely
because,
will.
Because you will find the three-page, three reprints there, which will be very helpful to you, I think.
Right. And so you talk in this memoir explicitly about how Blackett's influence...
Yes, you have asked his influence, and I think in the context of the immense expansion of physics in Manchester after the war, you will find this set out very clearly there.
Now, what about the his influence in terms of, for instance, getting funding for the Big Dish? Was he important in this also?
Well,
you going out and battling?
No, not at all. No, that is described in detail in the story.
It is.
Back. He was extremely important there.
Okay.
It is.
Let me ask about the whole meteor radar thing. One sees reports, and there are even suggestions in the literature back in the early 30s that... that radar meteor trails may give off radar scattering, or hold it, I'm getting mixed up. In the early 30s, Skellet and others.
Schaefer and Skellet. Yes.
Right.
Yes.
But they were not talking about radar echoes, I don't think.
Yes, they were.
They were?
Yes.
Even at that stage?
Yes. Oh, yes, very much so.
Okay.
Yes. If you want the history of that, you will find it in an account of us, in about 1947-1948, we had a symposium in Manchester under the aegis of the Physical Society, and I think I may be able to send you a reference to that, because this is really also very important. And Atherton, for example, when he learned what we were doing, he was a great man for establishing his own priority.
Yes.
And he claimed that they'd done all these observations, both of the meteors and of the aurorae, in the second International Geophysical Year, 1931-32, I think, something
right.
like that.
And he, of course, he also went back and tried to claim priority on the solar burst.
That's right.
Saying that amateurs had written in and this sort of thing.
So, would you like me to send
yes,
you the card?
Yes, please.
Yes, sir.
I'm not familiar with that.
Yes.
This is a meeting on meteor astronomy.
I can't quite remember whether it's there or whether it is a special article I wrote for Reports on Progress in Physics. I think it's a special article I wrote for Reports on Progress in Physics, which gives you all this early history.
I see. But now, we've talked about meteor radar astronomy, but how is it that other sorts developed? Why did Jodwell not confine itself only to pursuing this?
I think one of our first papers was on the great solar outburst of July 1946.
Oh, that's right.
And it is just one of these stream of accidents. We take the gear and begin to build arrays to look for cosmic ray showers. You will soon discover, particularly because of the accident of the great Jacobinian shower, and then you can convince everybody that this is the case, that the radio waves are not from cosmic ray showers but from meteors. And then in the middle of all this, one's equipment is completely obliterated by this enormous solar outburst. And by that time we had built this very big dish which looked into the zenith, 280 foot diameter.
Right.
We were then already seeing the variation in the noise level as the galaxy,
the galaxy plane
yes. Transits through the telescope. So this is how the situation developed. And so then of course we had very close contact with Raoul, and this is one of the things which people did find very difficult to understand, and I think they still do. Raoul and I were old friends, and we were never in any sense competitive in a bad sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this was difficult for many people to understand those days. Because the whole strength of radio astronomy in Great Britain's development has depended very critically on the correlation between Raoul and myself. I mean, if either of us at any time in the last 30 years had put a foot wrong or had been obviously in competition, then the administrations would have immediately seized us mm-hmm. and excuse to close the whole shop. That's in passing. You ask how we govern the other thing, well, just like that. You
so what you're saying is that the equipment just led you on from one thing to another.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then you see the equipment having led you on, and then one, by this time also, the designs, where we were wanting the big steerable telescope. And after all, we did some meteor work with the big telescope, but not very much. So.
Were you thinking of that as an important component when you first thought of the...
Yes, there is when I made the proposal for the 250 foot dish...
When was that first?
1947.
Oh, I see. 67. Well, you certainly would have been, yeah.
I wrote what became known as the Blue Book, which is referred to in my story, Dogger Bank, which I listed there, all the things that the big dish could do.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, you see, solar corpuscular streams, gegenschein. I was interested to hear, talking to Whipple about this, that there is now fairly definite proof, for example, that the gegenschein is a reflection, some reflection phenomenon associated with the zodiacal light, not big rock. But this was one of the cases that I had put down as a possibility for the use of the big dish.
How long is this document? I'd be very interested to see that.
Well, it's quite a short document, compared to the sort of proposal one has to put forward nowadays, to get £1,000 even, it's remarkably short.
Could you possibly send me a copy of that? That would be very interesting to see.
I could send you a copy. Obviously, it's never published, but it will.
Well, that's what makes it valuable. But there must have been many subsequent proposals as the idea developed
Yes.
What was that proposal for? How big a thing, and was it fully steerable and so forth?
It is.
So it was. You can. Definitely...
Yes, that is the proposal on which we got permission to go ahead.
Right.
But the sequence of those events is set out fairly precisely in my book. Sorry,
right.
You wouldn't have remembered it, but when you come to write about that period, you'll find it.
No, I know that. But let me ask, as took 10 years after that before the dish actually went on the air.
Yes.
During that time, did you begin to see that meteor radar astronomy had run its course more or less?
Yes.
And it would play out?
Yes.
When did you begin to recognize that, do you think?
I think when J.G. Davis had devised the three-station method for the measurement of the orbits of individual meteors. Remember, we cracked the method of measuring velocities and so on, mm-hmm. the distribution. And it then seemed, I think, apparent to a lot of us that the main issues then before meteor astronomy had been cracked, and one could go on to get heaps and heaps of PhDs out of it,
yeah.
but it would be rather a matter of cataloguing compared with the potentialities of what our Sturba dish could do in other aspects of the subject, which
right.
it has done.
Of course,
you must remember, we were doing meteors not only for the astronomical aspects, but also as a tool to study the atmosphere. I mean, a lot of the general work on meteors is concerned with the physics of the upper atmosphere,
right.
winds and
right.
rentals.
Right.
You say you've got our...
Yes, I have that list of all the Jodrell papers, yes, indeed. Which is very useful because it has many popular articles written by you, especially.
Well,
about,
in the early days, we put them in.
You know, things
in
Discovery and this sort of thing.
Yes.
Which I've traced down many of those.
Well, incidentally, if you can't find any of those in 1.9, I have got a reserve, a strategic reserve, so to speak. I could lend you some of those early articles
okay.
if you were interested in them.
Okay, well, I certainly am. I certainly am. Anything before, especially...
Well, you must write to me, because I couldn't possibly
right.
send them all to you.
Before 1952, I'm trying
well,
to...
Well, if anyone wants to see and would like to see them, I'll lend them to you, but don't ask me to send you the whole lot, because
no.
this will be advanced enterprise.
No.